Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to Lob Podcast from These Football Times. And in this mini-series called Icons, a number of the team from TFT Towers will be chatting about players, recent or past, who they consider worthy of being described as true icons of the football world. My name is Gary Thacker, and in this episode, I'm talking with Steve Scragg about one of his football icons. How are you doing, Stevie?
Oh, all good. Looking forward to this one.
Good man.
The juxtaposition to the one I've already spoken about, I think, here in so many ways.
Indeed. So both wore red, both wore seven. Tell us who you're going to talk about, Stevie.
I'm going Kevin Keegan. I think to draw the line between, you know, the parallels and the differences between those two iconic Liverpool number sevens, that, you know, between the two of them, you know, Kevin Keegan's debut in a Liverpool shirt in August 1971. To the last game that Kenny Dalglish played in the first team Liverpool shirt in May 1990. Almost two decades between, you know, first kick of the ball and last kick of the ball between the two, and the baton that was handed between them in the summer of 1977.
It just seemed a bit unfair that you got these guys across, as you say, two decades, 20 years, and, you know, two of the most successful, effective forward players, because both could drop a bit deeper as well. In Liverpool. So, yeah, okay. I guess Keegan had a different relationship with the players on the pitch than Dalglish did, but he still had an effective partnership with Toshack. You know, Toshack and Keegan was probably, you know, almost a classic little man's big man's situation. But tell us about that era when they were Toshack and Keegan, particularly Keegan, obviously was at their prime of Liverpool.
Yeah, proper kind of like chalk and cheese, yin and yang. Effect going on there, you know, Keegan, Mighty Mouse, short lad, but with, you know, rockets in his boots. You know, the phrase that Shankly used is go out there and drop hand grenades and all of that. You know, that was Kevin Keegan, a ball of energy and, you know, the dynamism, you know, all the way up to that last game he plays in a Liverpool shirt in the 77 European Cup final, and giving Bertie Vokes the run around, you know, an opposing marker, that he just gives such a torrid night in Rome, such a talented player in Bertie Vokes. And then, you know, Toshack, that big, you know, the broad shoulders, the hunched but broad shoulders, tall target man that could use his feet as well, you know, and two very different players that just connected so well together. But it was kind of like a relationship that almost never happened in some respects. You know, Keegan arrives at Liverpool in the summer of just before the 1971 FA Cup final, signed from Scunthorpe United. Several other First Division clubs had taken a look at him, including Everton and Leeds. They hadn't moved on him, done that classic, he's a bit short, we're not too sure. Shankly, you know, takes a punt. He's already got a talented lad that picked up from Scunthorpe in Ray Clements. And that probably thinks, well, why not? Let's see if Scunthorpe can come up trumps again. And Christ they do. So yeah, you know, he comes in, you know, either the 1971-72 season. You know, Liverpool have just, you know, reached and lost the 1971 FA Cup final. There's this changing of the guard that has been going on for the previous season and a half now. You know, after the Watford defeat in the FA Cup quarterfinals in February, I think it was, of 1970. You know, the fabled second great Shankly side, although there's more levels than that. It's kind of like a third great side, really, of Shankly's, maybe even a fourth. So, yeah, Keegan comes in. You know, Shankly's got an eye on him playing in midfield, but he, you know, plays in that classic pre-season Melwood fixture of the first team versus the reserves. You know, the reserves throw on the white shirts, the first team playing in red, you know, in this practice match, and Keegan just, you know, is... you know, magnetism in playing for the second string in this game, that, you know, Shankly looks and thinks, I can't not put him in. And actually, you know, thinks, I'm going to stick him up front, actually, you know, because of the chaos that he can cause for defenders, because he's just so that dynamism, that magnetism that he had, and that determination. Such a hard player to deal with for defenders. And he scores on his debut, home to Nottingham Forest, and he never looks back. He's not the most prolific of goal scorers, but it's because he plays such a varied game. He drops back into midfield, does play in midfield still sometimes. Pushes up front. He's the creator sometimes. He's the beneficiary on other occasions. And the interesting thing about John Toshak is that under Shankly, and I think it's certainly early under Paisley, there's a lack of certainty in Toshak. He plays the big games, but there are times when he's left out. That lack of pace sees Phil Borsma come in sometimes instead, especially away from home. They go for the pace rather than the tall presence of Toshak. So there's a lot of alternating that goes on over those years, and within that, Keegan has to cope with that. Different partners at times. Alan Waddle, uncle of Chris, comes in and plays a fair few games in 73-74. So there's that little bit of a doubt over Toshak, and because Toshak's involved in the big moments, he plays the 74 Cup final. He plays the 73 UEFA Cup final, and he's so synonymous with many of the big moments. It tends to fall under the radar that he was sometimes dropped out of the team for other circumstances, other target man's not really going to cut it in this game, but we need the pace of someone else. So he was sacrificed on many occasions, John Toshak. It's kind of 75, 76, late 74, 75. 75, 76, the first two thirds of 76, 77, where that partnership is unimpeachable. And, it is very much that partnership. But the two of them are just kind of like, Toshak Keegan 1-0, that David Coleman, Toshak Keegan 2-0. The UEFA Cup final first leg, the rearrangement of it, the rain that came down and saturated Anfield that made the game have to be called off after 30 minutes. Toshak's on the bench and Brian Hall is playing that game instead. Shankly and Paisley see this aerial vulnerability in the Gladbach defence. So Toshak starts the following night to such devastation alongside Keegan. And, Keegan is such a key part, key component in that second coming of Liverpool under Shankly, and, coming and winning the league in 72-73 of being denied it in 71-72 by virtue of a disallowed goal, which many people who were there at the time, there's no camera footage of it, will swear blind that it was wrongly called offside. To win that first European trophy for Liverpool in 73, to win the FA Cup, his performance in the 74 FA Cup final, just magnificent. The two goals he scores, that iconic line from, again, David Coleman, in goals pay the rent and Keegan does his share. This was the Liverpool of Keegan, and Keegan was very much a Shankly man. Shankly adored Keegan in the same vein that, he had so much time for Emlyn Hughes. It was that enthusiasm and that unwillingness to stop, that willingness to run through metaphorical brick walls, but to have that talent at their disposal as well. So Keegan was massively influential, and the fact that he would be succeeded by Dalglish, kind of, and the fact that he would eventually leave by his own volition is another one that kind of soured is his legacy for a lot of Liverpool fans for a long time, because people shouldn't be choosing to leave Liverpool because we are the pinnacle. That was the as arrogant as that might sound, that's just the way it was. For me, Keegan was never quite the property of Liverpool Football Club in the way that Dalglish was, but that doesn't mean that he shouldn't be reclaimed. And I think there is a bit of a movement now to see that Keegan legacy at Liverpool reclaimed, and the Keegan of Liverpool to be celebrated more than it perhaps has been, and rightly so that it should be. But yeah, that Keegan of Liverpool's was just such a magnificent component in a team that was being rebuilt, as well.
Yeah, I want to touch on his post-Liverpool career afterwards, but just sort of, I always think, focus on his years at Liverpool, I always think Keegan is a difficult player to pin down for two reasons, two different aspects. Firstly, you mentioned the word chaos and dynamism. That was it. He's almost like, touch on your your sort of favourite Hanna-Barbera characters. He was like the Tasmanian devil, sort of everywhere, chaos, everywhere he was going was sort of enthusiastic and dynamic. And the other thing where you couldn't pin him down is his position, because where does he play? You know, he had that versatility, a little bit like Dalglish as well. As you say, he started off in midfield and played. So I think for two different reasons, he was so difficult to pin down. And both of those are massive assets for Liverpool.
Yeah, hugely. I mean, to be part of that Liverpool ethos as well is that, you know, some football teams would play like Subutio teams or table football teams, and in being rigid to stay in a certain position, in a, you know, to be a certain part of the pitch that you were deployed in, and that was your patrol, and you stayed there and you didn't move elsewhere. Whereas Liverpool, very continental in their approach. You know, you know all about that Ajax ethos of the interchanging of positions. And that's why Liverpool players being defined in certain positions is so difficult to do. You can't really paint them in that respect. Yes, they, you know, a player might operate predominantly in the final third or the central third of the pitch or the first third of the pitch. But that movement and that freedom of movement is, you know, so emblematic of those teams. It was a, you know, total football in Scouse terms. So Keegan, he would backtrack. He would chase players down in his own half. He would, you know, drop into midfield and pull wide. Look at his goal against Saint-Étienne in the quarterfinal of the European Cup that catches Kirkovic out. You know, he hits it from the left wing, basically. You know, so Keegan wasn't predominantly, you know, central. He wasn't, you know, and that's the thing. He pulled his markers here, and because so often there would be a marker detailed to follow him. So if he pulled central defenders all over the pitch, creating, you know, space for others to prosper. And that Liverpool midfield, especially a player like Terry McDermott, that prospered so much from that type of space and those late runs that he would make into the space and to the edge of the area, into the penalty area. So many of those, the magnificent goals that McDermott scored up to the end of the 76-77 season. And he would score fantastic goals beyond. But, you know, you look at some of those goals from 76-77 that McDermott scored, owe so much to Keegan's movement and his intelligence in dragging players out of position. So there's that selfless aspect to it, which, you know, again ties into, he scored 100 goals all in all for Liverpool, which is a lot of goals over, you know, still a lot of goals, but in all competitions. But if you look at his league stats, I think he, you know, we're not talking about 20 a season, you know, but a lot of that was down to his selflessness. And you can look later in his career when he's at Southampton and Newcastle, where maybe he does become that little bit more selfish in front of goal, that he goes on to prove that he can be a prolific goal scorer. But that wasn't the job that he was given for Liverpool. He was given a, you know, a varied, wide remit on you know, what he was to do. And this is what he offered to Liverpool. He was so much more than just a striker, you know, a goal scorer of goals.
Just one more thing before we move on to his post-Liverpool career. Keegan was also became a personality off the football field as well. So he did, I think he did a Brute advert with Henry Cooper, didn't he? And then he did his pop song, Head Over Heels.
His pop career, yeah.
Yeah, pop career. I mean, I guess, you know, he sort of had that outside football personality as well. And perhaps it was something that his sort of fairly sort of bubbly attitude at that time sort of fed into a little bit as well. Did that, do you think that detracted from his time on his attitude in the game at all?
I don't think so. I think he is the barometer of modern day commercialism of sports stars. You know, football players, sports stars had previously, you know, they'd had kind of like commercial deals. You know, Fred Perry, his own range of sportswear. You know, you can look at football players having boot endorsements goes back a long, long way. You know, all that, but the concept of, you know, sports stars tipping up in television adverts and, you know, being, you know, television personalities, you know, his iconic performance on Superstars where he face plants on the bike, you know, all of that, you know, the Brute adverts with Tommy Cooper as well.
just like that.
You know, it really was kind of like template of what David Beckham would go on and amplify, for instance. Very much kind of like commercially minded, but it would always come back to the football. you know, first and foremost, you know, without a shadow of a doubt. So yeah, you know, a lightning rod in that respect, you know, for football, and you know, this he offers this template for future players to copy, basically, and you know, to photocopy and say, I'll do this. And you know, each generation that comes along has benefited them that more and more and more. But yeah, Keegan was very much, you know, at the forefront of that pioneer in that respect. For rights or wrongs, you know, likes and dislikes of sports stars doing that type of thing, it kind of does, you know, that modern era does start with Keegan.
Yeah. Okay, you mentioned earlier that when you left Liverpool, I mean, very few of, in that era of Liverpool, you know, dominance in Europe, and not only in domestic football, in European football as well, very few players left Liverpool, well, certainly at their peak, left Liverpool. But Keegan made the decision to decamp and go and play, not for another club in England, but go and play in Germany for Hamburg. Perhaps for Liverpool fans, it was a sort of difficult to understand, but it also was a brave move as well for a guy who'd only ever played in Scunthorpe and Liverpool to make that decision to go and play in another country, another language, another league, to test himself out, or was he sort of sated with the success he'd had at Liverpool?
I think, again, it's a multifaceted thing. You know, he's on one respect, he wants the new challenge. He wants a fresh challenge, playing abroad, you know, to be that challenge. You know, he's done everything he can in the English game, you know, apart from winning a League Cup, which still at that point in time, you know, isn't the you know, I don't know, if you've won the European Cup and league titles and FA Cups, you know, I don't think it's kind of like a problem if you don't win the League Cup as far as Keegan's concerned. So, you know, he wants this challenge. You know, what is he going to do? Go to another English club and try and unseat Liverpool? That's all you can kind of do. So beyond that, it's looking to the continent and challenge yourself in a completely different environment. And there were no shortage of interested parties. At that point in time, Italian football weren't allowing exports into the Serie A. So it was always going to be a case of either Spain or Germany. Real Madrid were heavily linked with him. You know, there was a lot of expectation. Bayern Munich were interested. So the great, and we're talking this Bayern Munich side, whose most recent European Cup was 1976. You know, so there was a lot of clubs eager to sign him. So yeah, he wanted the challenge. He wanted to do something new, but he would have also been had an eye on the extra earning capabilities that going playing abroad would have compared to English football at that point in time. So, you know, there was a lot of reasons for him to go and do that. You know, all he could do now with Liverpool is repeat the success that he'd already had, which for some personalities is absolutely fine. And that's what they want to do. And for others, you know, once they've done something, then they want to have an inbuilt need to move on to the next thing. You know, and Keegan would go on to prove himself to be that type of person. You know, his answer to leaving Hamburg was to tip up at Southampton, which no one expected. So yeah, you know, and then at Hamburg, you know, he reached another European Cup final, but they should have won, really, but they didn't. But he won a Bundesliga title, took them to a European Cup final, won two European Football of the Year awards. He just went from strength to strength to strength, and to go and do it in Germany as well. Learn a new language and all of that, and to try and fit in and be part of that, you know, was an incredibly. But and again, yes, other players have been abroad from British football, but not many had prospered. John Charles aside, you know, most were back quite quickly. But Keegan, again, you know, he loved the lifestyle over there, and you know, once he felt he'd done all he could, you know, he was the littlest hobo and off down the road again.
It's interesting that you mentioned the European Cup final. He came so close to being one of a very few players who could claim to have won the European Cup with two different clubs. I mean, that would have been a, you know, talismanic thing. And I remember the final when they played against Forest, and typical redoubtable Forest performance under Clough. And Keegan was that sort of, I remember this, the second half when they was chasing the game. He was going back to pick the ball off from the goalkeeper. Is that sort of determining, tends to drive this team to save the sort of game, but obviously it wasn't to be. But as you say, you know, two hugely successful seasons with Hamburg, certainly domestically, won the European Player of the Year twice. And then, as you say, he turned up at Southampton. Not exactly the sort of club you'd expect a player of that success, that sort of standing at the time to. But it was also perhaps a little bit typically Keegan-esque as well to do that.
Yep, totally. Liverpool did have an option on him, you know, that had been put into the transfer, you know, when Keegan became available at Hamburg again for Liverpool to have first hit Paisley, having signed a young lad by the name of Ian Rush and had opted not to take up that option. Manchester United were sniffing around him. There were other options to continue playing abroad. Italy had opened its borders in the summer of 1980 as well. So Serie A was suddenly a proposition as well. But he opted to return to England. He wanted this two-year build-up to the 1982 World Cup. He'd been denied participation in the 74 and 78 World Cup by, you know, talented collectives poorly organised that failed to qualify for the 1974 and 1978 World Cup. So, you know, he had that eye on the 1982 World Cup, and he wanted to prepare for it by playing first division football, and and that's what he went and did. He, you know, played a part of an entertaining Southampton side, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, that were a little bit Harlem Globetrotters in many respects. Is that, you know, Laurie McMenemy had this propensity to pick up star players, star names, and put them in the team, and, you know, again, you know, alongside maybe some others that were a bit more pragmatic, shall we say. Alan Ball, you know, had been there, you know, Dave Watson. He would go on to sign Peter Shilton. You know, he brought McShannon back from Manchester City. Alan Ball, you know, Mick Mills would sign for them eventually. He liked to pick up these big name players. So in many respects, I suppose, it was a surprise, but it maybe shouldn't have been. But the fact that, you know, you're looking at Kevin Keegan, a player who's just been back-to-back European Football of the Year, he's just played in the 1980 European Cup final, just been to the 1980 European Championship finals with England, their first major competition for a decade, and then suddenly he's being unveiled at the Dell to a press pack and a watching nation that is utterly, utterly stunned. But, you know, again, he loves life down in Hampshire. I went to the Dell many times and loved it. That kind of close to the pitch, and, you know, such a unique atmosphere and stadium that was. And he played some great football. Personally, you know, played some of the best football of his career in the Southampton shirt. Scored goals for fun. He was top scorer, 81, 82 possibly. But yeah, you know, couldn't help them to trophies, but because of inconsistencies. You know, collectively. But they were in with a shout in 81-82, the league. One of many teams that actually hit the front and gave way. It was an amazing run, 81-82. Liverpool eventually prevailed, thankfully, you know, from my perspective. But, you know, Swansea, you know, Manchester City for a while, Southampton, you know, Ipswich, you know, it was this mad title race where one team would hit the front, then stumble. Another team would hit the front and then stumble. And then eventually Liverpool down the back straight, you know, picked up the baton and blasted through the finishing tape. So, yeah, you know, what might have been for Southampton in 81, 82. But, you know, I always remember that game at the Dell when Liverpool went there late in the season and won 3-2. And young Ronnie Whelan was magnificent in that game. And Keegan scoring a penalty. None of that kind of, like, I can't celebrate scoring a goal against a former club. He was off and away punching the air and all that type of stuff, and being part of that. And again, YouTube clacks and go and look it up. Southampton's goal that Shannon scores in that game. It's just a magnificent game of football. If you're allowed to have a favourite goal that your own team has ever conceded, that Nick Shannon goal in 81-82 at the Dell, it's just unreal. Go find it. So yeah, you know, he prospered, and he should be set up for the 1982 World Cup. Absolutely perfectly. You know, everything is, you know, doesn't quite work out.
It's interesting. I mean, I always, you look back at Keegan's career and you think Southampton was almost like a summer holiday. He got the, you know, playing a top club of Liverpool, top club of Hamburg, pressure to win trophies, pressure to succeed. At Southampton, the pressure was different Nobody's expected to. I mean, you know, they had a little bit of a challenge at one time, but they no one's expected Southampton to win the league, the European Cup. It was almost like a little bit of pressure was off there. But of course, after that, then before we move on to his touch briefly his managerial career, I just want to refer to his time at Newcastle, and it seemed that there was another. It seemed where he'd gone back into the expectation thing again at Newcastle, where I mean, Newcastle have always been a sort of I hate the phrase big club. A club of expectant fans, shall we say, who expect, you know, to do well, even though they haven't had any trophy success for a while. But he became that talisman at Newcastle, didn't he, for those few seasons he was there?
He did, you know, post 1982 World Cup. He probably felt with Southampton that he'd come as close to substantial honours as he could possibly get. And then he's just had that light switch moment. I need to move on. I need to do something else. You know, and Southampton desperately wanted to keep hold of him. And then he has this you know, bust up in with Bobby Robson over being dropped from the England squad and all that type of stuff. But yeah, the Newcastle move. And again, you know, there's plenty of options on the table for him. You know, he could go abroad again. Once again, Manchester United come in for him, and then Newcastle. They kind of like plug into that romanticism of Keegan. You know, his granddad had been a huge Newcastle fan. His family had been, you know, Newcastle. So, you know, although he'd been born away from Newcastle, you know, that was the ancestral home. And, you know, it felt like a homecoming to him. It felt the most natural thing in the world. And a local brewery, you know, chipped in with his wages, you know, to help pay for his wages. And he just went for it. You know, 2 years at Newcastle, again scoring a raft full of goals, eventually teaming up with Terry McDermott, who would return to Newcastle before too long as well to team up with them. The emergence of Chris Waddle, you know, the arrival of Peter Beardsley, it all clicked into place 83-84 to win promotion in, I don't know, style, but, you know, a little bit dysfunction at times, but, you know, some wonderful style as well there. And they kind of became everyone's second favourite team because, you know, this emergence of Beardsley and Waddle was great, but, you know, Dermot and Keegan still doing it, you know, two, you know, different pairs at the each at the further end of each other's career spectrum in that respect. And, you know, they became a joy to watch. They were always, you know, hear their goals, you know, involving Newcastle at the end of the big match or whatever. You know, there was plenty of camera footage of them that season. But then within that, the FA Cup tie at Anfield when Newcastle come to Liverpool, a Friday night fixture, and Keegan knows that he's not got it in his legs to be able to compete at that level anymore, which is the precursor to his eventual retirement, which for many players, and is still in his relative early 30s, many other players would carry on. And for Keegan, it was like, no, if I can't punch my weight going into the first division at the highest level, he didn't want to tread water. You know, he didn't want to be a mid-table water treader in the first division with Newcastle, and he decided, no, I'm bowing out. I've helped you back into the first division. Now I'm off and away.
Yeah. Okay. I've talked with Thomas Rice, but it'd be sort of folly not to touch on his managerial career. I mean, England perhaps wasn't great. He said himself that he was a little bit beyond him, but he had relative success as club manager. When we were talking of Fulham, and you mentioned about Newcastle. The Newcastle side of the Kings, for certainly his first iteration there, was they were a great entertaining team as well, and came so close. And there was the classic Liverpool Newcastle 4-3 game. I mean, you know, as entertainment, I mean, I just wasn't either of those teams, but it was a great match to watch. Entertained, pulsating almost, and you know, and it's the swings backwards and forwards. Liverpool were in front, Newcastle were in front, and the classic. I think Colin Moore got the last goal, didn't think to end it at 4-3, and Keegan slumped over the hoardings, and you could see how what it meant to him. So yeah, even as a manager, he had his sort of desire, his drive was perhaps greater than his success and his ability, shall I say. And it was that enthusiasm that charged down the hill with the flags unfurled, cavalry going down, you know, what's a plan B? I don't know, I've got a plan B. I've got a plan A and I've got a plan B, which is the same as plan A.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's that, again, used the word, you know, juxtaposition between Dalglish and Keegan, where, you know, Dalglish wins the league, clinches the league with a loss at Anfield, you know, the previous season. That 95-96 loss for Keegan, you know, the difference there between the two events. you know, an unlikely manager. I don't think he had any, you know, he quit as a player and said, that's it with me with football. He was happy to be kind of talking head for ITV. You know, he was always there as a pundit or a co-commentator to Brian Moore on big games that ITV would cover. You know, and you know, his agreement to take over at Newcastle, you know, 91-92, you know, even then within agreeing just a short span to the end of the season to try and help them stay in the second division, and then I'm out of the picture, because he just seemed the most unlikely of managers, because he'd always said it was something he would never do and he had no interest in doing. So when he picked up the bat, and it was because it was Newcastle, you know, that he said yes. And then it opened up a whole new, you know, facet of Keegan's relationship with football. You know, to go on and, you know, take them into the Premier League, to, you know, set them up to be winners of the Premier League in 95-96, only to you know, for it to unravel. So, you know, and again, you know, that Keegan propensity to say, I'm out now, that's it. When he walks away from Newcastle, what was it, the January of 97, the December 96, January 97, not long after they've dismantled Manchester United 5-0 at St James Park. You know, that signing of Alan Shearer and all of that. You know, never a dull moment, you know, with Keegan. You know, and then, yeah, he shouldn't undersell what he did with Fulham, and reluctantly took on the England job in a similar way that he'd reluctantly initially taken on the Newcastle job. You know, that romanticism that had led to that. You know, he would have been better off served by staying at Fulham and being the man to take them into the Premier League. He was building something with momentum and special at Craven Cottage when, you know, he took on the England job. And then that short spell, you know, back in charge of Newcastle, you know, enjoyed his time at Manchester City. You know, and I think the hallmark, yeah, the trophies eluded him. But, you know, he always set his teams up to play entertaining football. You know, again, that juxtaposition with Dalglish. Dalglish did create entertaining football teams as a manager as well, but successful ones that won trophies. So, you know, it's always fascinating, this, you know, these differences and similarities between Keegan and Dalglish. But yeah, Keegan flawed in a way that Dalglish never was in that respect, but it makes him utterly lovable and human. It's a few years ago now, probably not long before COVID. You know, say go back to that relationship with Liverpool, and Liverpool need to reclaim the Keegan of Liverpool, you know, because he, as a player, as a personality, he seems to, you know, he belongs to Newcastle, he belongs to the nation, you know, but he does belong to Liverpool as well. And he was at a game at Anfield as a guest, and he arrived at Anfield and supporters of a certain age were just delighted to see him, and they were getting selfies with him and everything. And whereas for some players, some footballers, you know, that's a difficult thing for them to do, and they want to be out of there as quick as possible. Not Keegan. He signed every single autograph. He took every bear hug, every you know, photo, just with the biggest smile imaginable. You know, and there's you know, a mark of the man as well.
Brilliant. That's been a great chat, Stevie. So massive thanks to Steve for sharing his thoughts on the icon that is Kevin Keegan. So thanks for listening. Catch us again on the next episode of the LOD podcast from These Football Times.
Many thanks for joining us today on the LOB, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.